It's Friday, which means it's time to get you up to date on all of the news that made headlines this week in our region. And there was a lot. Joining me live in studio today for our reporter roundtable are Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television, Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, and Seth Ogilvy with Idaho Public Television. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jim. Thanks.
Okay, so, you know, it's still what people are talking about, and that was that wild visit to Wilder on Monday. So it was Monday, right?
It was Tuesday.
Okay. It was earlier in the week.
I think it feels like Monday because we all started hearing about it late Monday.
That's right. Okay.
After Nicole Foy broke that story that Ivanka Trump and Tim Cook from Apple were coming to Wilder. And then I think we all got on email and started frantically emailing Jeff Dillon, emailing the White House, trying to figure out what was going on there, and basically got the pushback of, oh.
Nothing's going on. Nothing's here.
Even though we have letters to the parents, nothing's going on.
And
then when they finally admit, there's just no access, not even a reason to come out there. So inevitably, we all wander out there at 7:30 in the morning, sit in the cold for about 5 hours, and get a little photo op of Ivanka and Tim as they go into the school. But really ended up talking to the students, the parents, the protesters out there, because we weren't allowed access.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our story that we could actually cover was people angry because we weren't in there to see how these iBooks and all these iPads were working.
So let's talk about that, because beyond whether you agree with, you know, the Trump administration and Ivanka Trump being there, Tim Cook, you know, showing up, I think maybe part of the story that tended to be a bit overlooked was this Apple education and the fact that there were people coming out saying that they had issues with it, and not just parents, you know, but students. And I don't think we've really heard a lot about that.
I think it was an opportunity for some of these parents out there who feel like their concerns over that program have not been addressed to finally get the concerns out. And I mean, you think about this, Idaho's been wrestling with this notion of technology in the classroom for what, a decade or more. Mm-hmm. And so now you had this really interesting example happening in real time, a debate on what is the best way to learn. And I think, you know, Seth put his finger on something. What ended up being the story out of this was almost the media management notion. Because there was such a lockdown on information, people were wondering, well, why are they doing it? And why are they doing it this way? And if you think about the world's most, maybe the world's most powerful CEO and one of the world's most powerful advisors to the most powerful man in the world coming to Wilder, Idaho in the middle of the week, it was just such an odd thing that was almost the story as opposed to what they were doing in Wilder.
And then no access, because not even, and beyond the media access, because even when we discussed this on the program, you know, we had a couple of emails where people saying, you know, media doesn't always have to be at everything. And I mean, we can discuss that at a later time. But, you know, part of it, too, was that we have had dignitaries come to Idaho before. We have had presidents. We have had first ladies come. And not only does the media know about it, our governor knows about it. That didn't happen this time around.
No, it didn't. And I reached out to a couple of the constitutional officers. They said that they found out about it pretty late. One person also said, and I have better things to do, to be honest, at this point. But I think getting back to the access point of view of it all, I don't know if there was a good way in which this story would be spun.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if we got in there and we did really talk about this technology, inevitably what we're going to talk about is Wilder is not a good school. Wilder's numbers are terrible. Their reading numbers are terrible. Their math numbers are terrible. They've been actually highlighted by the State Department of Education as a failing school. They have not been doing great work with – I mean, the iPads might be great, and I think everyone would take an iPad, but they're not leading to good education outcomes.
Well, and to be fair, we are going to be doing a program on December 19th about this mastery-based education and the difference between that and just bringing technology into the classroom. Because I do think that when we've had these discussions and when we focus solely on Wilder, it is about, you know, how they're doing, where there have been some successes. So we are going to be having a broader discussion on that. So just wanted our audience to know that we're not slamming Wilder, but there are questions I think that came up about does this putting an iPad in the hands of every child really work or not.
Well, and it's like it's a tool like any tool. A hammer's not necessarily bad,
right?
But you can hammer improperly with a hammer. Mm-hmm. It's about how you use it and what you're doing with it, as opposed to the iPad itself. I think everyone would gladly
take
an iPad.
And this really goes back to the debate that Idaho had about the Luna laws, mm-hmm. and the role of teachers in mm-hmm. the classroom and the role of technology. And I think that the voters made it clear back then that in Idaho they're really pretty focused on the teaching and the technology, as you all said, as a tool.
Right, so Bill?
There's a way you do this, right? I mean, we don't have to be professional PR people to know that you don't send Tim Cook somewhere unprepared to talk about the app, the way we learn with technology. And you don't send Ivanka Trump into a school with 75% Latino enrollment without being prepared to talk about the administration's concerns with Hispanics and with mm-hmm. migration. And so the whole thing just felt badly managed. And if you think about, you know, the 2015 visit by Barack Obama, you know, he came here with a specific message and a specific theme, you know, picking up off of his State of the Union address. He was going to talk about innovation and the culture at Boise State. And it was very carefully managed. It was very carefully stage managed. There was a pool report. Mm-hmm. But they work all that in advance so that at least there seems to be a reason and a method to the madness.
And, right.
And one of the ironies is if they would have actually you saw in the ABC interview what was actually talked about with the access. It was the emails. It was Ivanka's like unprotected email servers. Kind of ironic that they're talking about technology and she's got a technology problem. And then she goes to, like you said, this very large Latinx community when there's tear gas being shot at the border, and a lot of right. people just saw that as kind of a slap in the face that she would show up to this community right after that happened.
I want to shift gears now because on Election Day, Ontario, they voted to allow marijuana dispensaries within their city limits. So in January, things are going to change a little bit. But since then, we've kind of had found out about this odd connection with Brent Crane, correct, Bill? Is that a good way to put
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, Seth is the expert on this story.
Okay,
but
all right.
Essentially, you know, an Idaho, very conservative Idaho politician who's part of the crusade against marijuana in Idaho. His company is providing security for some of the companies in Oregon.
Yeah, so talk to us about this stuff.
Yeah, so Crane Alarm Systems there's been rumors that they've been providing security to the Hot Box Farm over in Huntington, Oregon, mm-hmm. for a while. I've kind of heard them. I didn't pay it much mind because it didn't seem that important. But recently, some pictures started floating around with lobbyists and people in the know of the Crane Alarm sticker on the Hot Box Farm. So I just went out there to see, like, is this true? And then I...
Sure, that's why you went out there. Yeah.
This coming from the guy who always wants
that's
to talk
why,
about marijuana.
You know what?
Going to Pendleton,
everybody with that 1A license plate, they're just driving through.
Yeah, surprisingly, 1A and 2 seat, a lot of them out there. So I went out there, and indeed, there was a sticker, but I called Representative Crane to make sure, like, hey, is this sticker just from a previous business? Did they acquire a sticker? And he said, no, they do provide security for Hot Box Farms out there. He said he can verify that because he does the invoicing. He's one of the ones that actually does the bills. So it's assistant majority leader of the House, and let's not forget the president of the company is the current treasurer of the state of Idaho, who
where's the problem?
and legally, there's absolutely no problem.
Honestly, legally, there is no problem. This is a business. They can do this.
It's a hypocrisy issue, right? I mean, the people who want to raise this are bringing it up as a hypocrisy issue. And I think also just my sense, and we have two experts on the Idaho legislature sitting next to me, but Crane is not necessarily a popular guy over there. And so I think people who don't like him found a way to try to embarrass him.
And he's in the midst of a run for speaker.
Right.
He has announced
Absolutely.
That he's challenging Scott Behnke yep. for speaker, and the election is next week in the caucus.
And then this comes up.
Yes, exactly.
And the Idaho legislature has been adamant, particularly the conservative Republicans in the legislature have been adamant that Idaho will not go the way of its neighbors on legalized marijuana, either for medical or recreational use. But as all the states around us move in that direction, we're mm-hmm. going to see more and more overlap like this. This is, in fact, a legal activity and a business that's happening in our neighboring states, and it overlaps and it has implications for us here in Idaho.
And Bill, you make a good point. I mean, it's the hypocrisy of it where it's like not here. However, we will find a way to make money somewhere else with it.
Yeah. It's so I mean, I think Betsy said it right. There's this moment we're having here in Idaho where we're being surrounded by these states, and you're going to have people, you know, who live literally minutes from legal marijuana, potentially being subject to criminal prosecution for an activity that's legal across the border. So I think this is an issue that Idaho is going to have to wrestle with in a more sophisticated, nuanced way than just this, you know, never marijuana, never in Idaho, the perspective that we've had.
And it's a literal example of putting your money where your mouth is. I mean, if a lot of legislators found out that Crane or someone else was donating to Planned Parenthood after making speeches against Planned Parenthood, I think it would have the same effect. It's just you can say one thing in the legislature, and then what are you doing in your private life to actually live up to those values?
Well, and so speaking of marijuana and the fact that it's illegal here, and we see a lot of people going to jail because of that, Betsy, you have an article coming out about the whole justice reinvestment going on here in Idaho.
So my article in today's Idaho Press is about a new report that's out today from the Urban Institute about justice reinvestment in Idaho. And interestingly, this report found that they look specifically at parole releases and some major problems that have been highlighted in Idaho, where we were keeping people far, far, far beyond their potential parole eligibility date, 150-175% of their fixed term, that has improved since we began justice reinvestment. But at the same time, absolutely no increase in recidivism. And what's especially interesting about this is that the major changes that Idaho enacted in 2014 under justice reinvestment to try to speed up, kind of take out some bottlenecks in its parole release system, a lot of those were reversed in 2017. At the urging of the Idaho Prosecutors Association and the Fraternal Order of Police, some major changes to how parole releases worked in Idaho were reversed, and a major kind of statement of intent for justice reinvestment was repealed and replaced with some softer language that more accommodates locking up drug users for long periods of time in prison. So at the same time that we're seeing some gains from some of these reforms and no increase in recidivism, we also have a skyrocketing prison population again. And so the authors of the report at the Urban Institute said the problem now appears to be at the other end, at the sentencing end. It's the sentences that we're handing down, and we are essentially turning to prison for some more minor offenses, and that's contributing to our prison problem.
So what's interesting with that, though, is that a lot of our sentences, though, there are mandatory minimums when it comes to drug sentences.
Exactly, and particularly for the offense that's called drug trafficking. Mm-hmm. So drug trafficking is a crime in Idaho that is defined as possession of a certain amount of specific drugs, and there's a certain amount that's set for each drug, and if the person possesses that amount, they are guilty of drug trafficking and they get a mandatory minimum sentence, whether they were selling it or not. And so the legislative committee that's been overseeing justice reinvestment has voted to reexamine those mandatory minimums in the upcoming legislative session and to make several other significant changes. And there's a proposal for a $500 million prison expansion. A lot of people are saying they don't want to do that, but our prisons are overflowing. Mm. We're shipping the inmates off to Texas. We've got to do something with them. And I spoke just yesterday with Senator Patty Ann Lodge, who is the co-chair of that oversight committee, and she said, you know, if we're not going to build a new prison, what are we going to do? We will have to make some changes.
And then we find out that the director of the Idaho Correction is retiring. Henry Utensio, December 31st, is retiring. And that kind of throws a whole wrench into this whole process.
It does. Plus, the House Judiciary Chairman, Representative Lim Luker, lost his reelection bid, and he was a key player in this as well. So there's some turmoil, some turnover at the same time. We've got a new governor coming in. I mean, it's really going to be up to the governor to provide some leadership with a new director at the helm as to how we're going to approach this problem.
And I don't remember this being much of an issue in the campaign or hearing much from Little about this. So, I mean, he's a thoughtful guy, and he's been a long time, so it would be interesting to see what he does.
Absolutely. This is a big problem for the legislature, and they're going to need to deal with it.
And sitting in on a Board of Correction meetings this summer, you definitely didn't – they didn't sound like this problem was solved either. They were looking at about 60% of the people going into prison were actually coming off of a rider or probation or parole. So although the recidivism rate isn't necessarily going up, there are a lot of people that are being released and then coming right back to prison, maybe just for violations of probation, parole, or the rider, maybe not a new crime, but they are coming back
in. And we've had many critics come on this program talking about the fact that, you know – we locking someone up for a drug problem doesn't solve the problem.
Well, and that's we talk about a moment in time, and you know, Betsy just laid out some of this the opportunities we have. But if you think about this, this isn't one of those issues that circles around where liberal meets conservative on the backside, right? And you have President Trump making proposals along these lines, and you have Raul Labrador making proposals along these lines. This does not have to be a partisan issue. And I think there is this growing recognition that we've got to figure out a different way to treat these people for humanity. Sake and for budget sake.
And also the Urban Institute report pointed out that basically research shows that locking people up longer for lesser offenses does not keep society safer. It just costs a whole bunch more money.
Back with our Friday Reporter Roundtable, my guest today, Betsy Russell with Idaho Press, Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television, and Seth Ogilvie with Idaho Public Television. Betsy, let's talk about Medicaid expansion and this lawsuit that's being brought by the Idaho Freedom Foundation.
Right. The lawsuit has been filed, and just last night their brief was filed laying out their arguments. And essentially, the Freedom Foundation is trying to argue that somehow the initiative is unconstitutional. I spoke with the author of the initiative, Luke Mayville, just yesterday, and he said it's essentially identical to what 30 other states have enacted. And the Attorney General's certificate of review for the initiative concluded that it was constitutional. But the argument that the Freedom Foundation is raising is that it's an inappropriate delegation of legislative authority by the legislature to the executive branch and the federal government because of the way the wording of the initiative cites federal law. Essentially, they're saying that if it just said, oh, we should do what it says in this section of federal law as currently enacted, that it would be okay. But since as currently enacted was left out, that we're opening ourselves up to future federal changes without legislative approval. I think that's an argument that certainly could be questioned, and I think will be. And there are also some procedural issues with the case. It's very interesting. I spoke with Brian Smith, the attorney for the Freedom Foundation, just this morning. Mm-hmm. And I did talk with him about a lot of noise on social media about the fact that he owns a medical debt collection service, and he's filed thousands of lawsuits over medical debt, and questioning whether he has a conflict of interest in this area. And he told me, I have no more conflict of interest than any doctor in this state who gets federal payments for providing medical care. He said, I only collect medical debt from people who can pay, and people who would be affected by Medicaid expansion can't pay, so I wouldn't be collecting from them anyway. He pretty much was dismissive of the idea that created any kind of conflict. He also made it clear that he is philosophically opposed to Medicaid expansion in line with the views of the Idaho Freedom Foundation, that he believes it's a redistribution of wealth and that it's not the role of government. Obviously, a large majority of voters disagreed with that, and that was the position that won out in the election.
And I think it's always important to remember that anyone can sue anyone about anything. I mean, just filing a lawsuit doesn't mean anything's going to happen. I mean, a court still has to take up the lawsuit. Mm-hmm. They have to have standing. They have to show all these things. I can sue many. That doesn't mean I necessarily have any.
Bill just looked at you like, what?
Standings or anything like that. But
my lawyer's going to hear
you. Yeah, exactly.
And then I think we also have to remember that, you know, although we like to think of the judicial branch as someone devoid of politics and things like that, a lot of people in the, you know, on that side of the government have always reminded me that it's not outside of politics. And this is a very popular thing. It would be very surprising if a Supreme Court or the court system as a whole had the guts to tell the people of Idaho, no, you're wrong. I mean, that's a pretty bold move for Supreme Court justices that do have to go out and get reelected.
And so I would argue that if this initiative were unconstitutional, the Supreme Court would say so. And they would rule in that manner. And they would – I mean, that's
because it's unconstitutional.
That's how our separation of powers works. But this is a pretty fine line issue that's being raised.
So, Seth, you happen to go up to Idaho City. And the reason why I bring this up is that Idaho Education News, Kevin Richard, who's been on the program and was on this week talking about this, he's done a really in-depth series this week about our go-on rates and why we are not, you know, even moving the needle really on that 60% goal by 2025, because it used to be 2020. And there is something that is sometimes that comes up, in particular with Idaho City, and this is the fact that they have had pre-K in place for going on 2 decades.
Yeah, this is a pilot project that you actually see results from. And I just have to say that I did not myself go up to Idaho City. I was in Wilder freezing my butt off in the cold rain.
You wish you'd been in Idaho City.
I was planning on, but I did something else. We've been working with Kevin. He'll be on our show tonight at 8 o'clock on Idaho Reports with Betsy, actually. But we've been working with him on, like, is there anyone who's doing it right? Are there any ways to get these kids to go on to college or to go on to a career technical training? And it's hard, but when you look at Idaho City, their numbers point to there might be a solution here, and it might be pre-K. They've been doing it for almost 19 years now. They've actually seen kids come through their program, graduate from high school, and go on to college. Now, some kids leave Idaho City, so their numbers, and some kids come in after pre-K, the population moves through. So their go-on numbers don't necessarily tell the entire story when you look at the whole. But when you look at just the kids that took pre-K, all those kids, if they stayed in the Idaho City school system, had no behavioral mediation problems, and all of them graduated from high school, and then all of them went to college at a rate of 65%. That's over the go.
So we met the. So we hit the mark.
If
you look at this test group,
this does it. This gets you that go on 60 rate if you do a pre-K program. And it's not like Idaho City is necessarily the most urban. You know, it's a fairly rural environment. There are fairly low economic folks there. This isn't just the rich white kids. I mean, this across the board, they're hitting these targets. And the only thing that's different, really, is the fact that they're doing pre-K.
Boy, that's fascinating.
Isn't that?
It really is.
And, you know, it's Idaho City is probably the best and longest example of that. But Caldwell's been mm-hmm. doing some experiments along these lines. There's a handful of Boise elementary schools that are doing this. And everywhere that you try it, you see results. And it's one of those cases akin to climate change or global warming, where the evidence is so overwhelming, and yet there's just – you know, philosophically, people just don't want to accept it. But if you think about what is it that makes success in kindergarten? These kids often are coming to school, and I happen to know a kindergarten teacher who lives in my household. kids are coming to school, and they don't know how to use scissors, and they don't know how to hold crayons, and they've never done a puzzle. And you know what they do know how they know how to swipe, and they know how to operate a device with their thumbs, but they aren't learning how to stand in line, and how to be patient, and how to listen, and how to get along with other kids. And those are all things you learn in preschool. Mm-hmm. And so we have we almost have an entire generation of kids who are coming into the school system unprepared to learn. And when you're not prepared to learn in kindergarten, and by the way, Idaho, kindergarten's still not mandatory.
And not even full day.
And definitely not full day. And so you're not ready to learn in kindergarten. You're not reading by the time you're in third grade. And in mm-hmm. many ways, you are lost to the system. And so there's this overwhelming evidence, and there's this sense in Idaho from the really smart people and the people who lead this effort that it wouldn't take very much to really move the needle. And so it's just so unusual that we keep having this conversation time after time after time. It feels like what Yogi Berra said, deja vu all over again.
And the teachers up in Idaho City will tell you that the kids that didn't go through the pre-K program, they are just constantly in remediation of trying to get them up to the mm-hmm. level that those pre-K kids had, because you're exactly right. They come to school and they don't know how to stand in line.
Right.
They don't know how to do some of the fundamental learning things. And going all the way full circle back to what Betsy was talking about before, the other thing is, these kids don't go to jail. I mean, yep. That's an important part too. This is an investment in the beginning that maybe doesn't mean you have to spend that money at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So as far as a sunk cost, $6,000 in the beginning that can save you $20,000 of prison time.
Right.
It might not even be that expensive in the whole.
And look, I'll get on my soapbox for a minute, and these are my own views. Being a parent to elementary school children and having one who is in first grade and having both children having gone through pre-K and full day kindergarten, it is a tremendous difference. And I think sometimes we don't realize that as a community.
Well, you know, you and Seth are both, you have it exactly right. It's not just the benefit of the individual child, which is as important as that is. That's the benefits to society. You're not remediating in high school. You're sending fewer kids to college who need remediation. You're keeping people out of the welfare system and out of the mental health system, and they have jobs where they can pay for their own health care costs. If you think about, you know, helping people be successful when they're 3 and 4 and 5 is a lifetime benefit for all of society. Mm-hmm. And how we continue to miss that is just tragic in my mind.
And remember that we have a new governor about to be inaugurated who had made this a substantial campaign issue and has been speaking out for years on the importance of pre-K.
And he's also said that he's going to unveil a big early education program. You have a couple of stakeholders that recently voted for something similar to this, mm-hmm. kind of a public-private partnership that would use grants, use private money to get these as an opt-in for certain school districts so that they could do pre-K if they moving forward. And getting back to Bill's point from earlier, I mean, it almost does work like global warming because you need a school district like Idaho City that's been doing it for 19 years so you can actually see it. If you just do a program for like 3 years, obviously you're not going to see the impacts of pre-K.
Right.
You need to actually get all the way through to the end
so
and getting
Idaho
those
City,
numbers together.
Idaho City's kind of like the tree rings. We can
exactly
see the effect.
Exactly. No, I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens when Brad Little takes office, to see what that plan looks like, but to also see what the legislature does, because this issue continues to come up. It comes up every single year in the legislature. There is only so much private money. So this is the conversation that will continue.
And I think some of the stakeholders think they might have a better chance with this idea of the opt-in that they didn't have with the idea of just creating a universal pre-K or kindergarten system, because there are a lot of communities that just don't want to do this because whether it's a church group or community groups, they're providing these services already and they don't want the duplication and taking it out of their control.
And I have to wrap this up. We didn't even hit all of the topics, but as always, such interesting conversation. I really appreciate you guys coming in. My guest today on our reporter roundtable, Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television, Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, and Seth Ogilvie with Idaho Public Television. Thanks again, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks,